Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio on July 19th, 2021. It's a pleasure to have you here today, as it is a pleasure to have my guest here today, first-time guest, who I'm very anxious to meet. It'll be Jed Appelrouth. Jed, I hope I pronounced Jed your last name right. I think I did Appelrouth. President of Appelrouth Tutoring. And this is a very fascinating company, okay, in the field of not only SAT and test prep tutoring, but also academic tutoring. And he's got some interesting methods to talk about, got a really nice, strong company. I learned about them. I decided to bring them onto the show. So Jed's here to talk about all the wonderful things that they do, okay, to help kids succeed. Okay, it's not just about the tutoring. It's about ways to get them to think and help them succeed all through school, all through higher ed, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm really looking forward to this show, okay, with Jed. I'll bring him on in 1 second. I just want to say we're going to archive the show over at ace-ed.org, ace-ed.org, ace-ed.org. That's where we archive all of our podcasts. That's where our magazine, Equity and Access Pre-K-12, is located, and it is a great issue. We archive every issue we've ever done over there. We do 6 a year. It's our online journal from our American Consortium for Equity and Education, of which this show here at Education Talk Radio, okay, is the voice of our consortium. We're doing great. We try to really get the word out about equity and access, making sure every kid has equal opportunity to learning. I'm sure we'll probably be even talking about that with Jed today. All right. I hope you join with us over at ace-ed.org, but please go over, see what we do, listen to any podcast. Enjoy our current issue. We'll have a new one up there at the end of next week. All right, and you can go back and see every issue we've ever done. So with all that said, again, ace-ed.org, I'm going to welcome Jed Appelrouth to the show. Hi, Jed. It's Larry Jacobs here.
Larry, hey. Happy to be here today.
Pleasure to have you here, my friend. Are you down in Atlanta? I see the 404.
Yeah, I'm here in Atlanta, Georgia, and I call from the 404. And yeah. It's my hometown. I grew up here and been here for many years.
Man, you don't have any Georgia accent. Am I missing something? Do I still have my Philly accent? What's going on?
I hear the Philly accent. Now, I spent 4 years in Philly for college. My father was from Key West, Florida, and he was born down in Key West. And my mother was born up in Queens, and they met
had
in
to meet
Florida.
Somewhere.
So, had to meet somewhere. They met in the middle. So my dad didn't really have a Southern accent. My mother had kind of a little bit of a New York accent. So it all washed out with me, and I really have no accent. So
you are the first descendant I've ever spoken to, I think, actually with actual genetic roots to the Conk Republic down in Key West.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
The first
my
one.
My family came over from Romania in like the 1880s. My great great grandmother, and she landed there, and they settled in Key West when it was a small fishing town. Yeah.
Wow.
So my dad and his family, they were born on Duval Street, and they had a store there, and then they moved to Miami when he was 10, and then he moved north after that. But, yeah, the Key West, the Conk Republic has always been important to my family history.
I'm sitting here with my mouth open. You're the first person I think I've ever met who literally has relatives going back generations in there. I think
we
that's
go back,
fascinating.
If you actually go and go to Key West, there's a street with my name on it. It was my Uncle Billy. And it's actually it's Appelrouth Lane. It's down in Key West. From my Uncle Billy was very civically involved with the community and very charitable, and they gave him a street. So,
Wow. Well, I want you to know that if this show goes well, I'm going to give you a street in Atlanta. I'm not stopping that.
I'll take it.
Okay. Actually, I'm not going to make it good with the city of Atlanta. I'm just going to give you the sign. You can probably put it up wherever you want to call your GPS company. Take it like that.
I like it.
Yeah.
We have a deal.
Simple. Appelrouth. Appelrouth. I got that, by the way.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jed. Although it looks like
no
Appelrouth. I do have to say that.
It does.
Everyone
has a coin and they flip it. Appelrouth, Appelrouth, and you're right half the time. So,
right. And
good.
By the way, and that's the website, everybody. And please go over. There's a very interesting website, Appelrouth, but it looks like Appelrouth.com, A-P-P-L-E. ROUTH.com. Okay, we're going to talk about unlocking all the student potential that you can do, but I wanted you to talk about the history of starting your company, which I think is around 2000. Am I correct, Jed?
It was in the fall of 2001, so we're coming upon 20 years.
Okay.
When I started off, my path was college. Then I went to, I did AmeriCorps out in New Mexico in Taos, and I taught in fifth grade, and then did some work in the Forest Service. Came back and spent 2 years working for McKinsey, a company flying around helping companies become more efficient and more effective. And then I hopped off the train and began doing some painting, some fine arts. I was selling my artwork in some galleries in Atlanta. And then I decided I needed some more revenue to help, you know, make ends meet. And I began tutoring. And you know what? The market said yes. The tutoring worked, and I began to really grow the company.
Yep.
And then I began to hire employees in 2003, and then we began to expand to different cities in 08, 09. And so then we have, you know, several hundred employees, and it's, you know, it's a real company. But it started off just me working in my living room.
Well, what I was going to say, you're doing a magnificent job at growing the company. Okay, and how many employees now? Say it again so people understand this.
Like tutors, like we have 250 tutors and about 50 full-time people working for us. We are a good employer, and you know, it's been fun learning how to grow a company and create a culture and take care of people, and you know, make a place for them to work and be happy and bring good vibes home and you know, for their families. And it's been a real pleasure, like making a place of work for my team.
You should be proud of yourself, and I know you guys do a good job with what you do. And what makes your tutoring, and you touched on this, okay, you have a system. You have some sort of approach, okay, and we're going to talk about this in detail, that makes your system work better than, I'll say it the way you would say it, other systems might, okay? Okay, again, it's appleruth.com, everybody. All right, tutoring. Talk about it. What is your system? What did you come up with? What went ding in your head, that eureka moment when you started tutoring, that allowed you to see a difference and then make it grow like this?
Well, the very first clients I worked with, I went back to my old high school, and I was just starting out. I printed up a brochure and a business card, and it's like, all right, let me work with some kids. And they began to give me students who were struggling academically. The kids who were getting C's and who were on the verge of, you know, having issues or failing out. And part of it was thinking, it was working with these kids and help kind of understanding, you know, their systems. I was coming from a background where I was doing consulting, okay? And I had spent, you know, some time out in teaching fifth grade, and then I spent several years helping companies, you know, figure out their problems. And so I was looking at it from, I think, a process side, and let me see your systems. How are you approaching things? Like, you know, when are you studying? Where are you studying? Show me your method. How are you memorizing? How are you prioritizing? How are you thinking about your academics? And also, what I learned very quickly was that there was a whole other side to this, the social-emotional component. And one of my first students was doing, like, some self-harm and was getting into drugs, other things. And we talked about this, and I realized that there's more here than just the academics. And the parents are going through a divorce. I actually took myself and went back to grad school, and I ended up getting a master's in counseling. And then I stayed on for a PhD in educational psychology in terms of how students learn. And so I really began to understand that, you know, even if I can help the student learn better systems and better approach and how to learn and when to learn, they have fundamental issues. Like, they don't want to succeed academically, and there's issues with the family. Like, I realized I had to address the entire student. I had to think about, because, you know, if their motivation is not right, or if there's like crippling anxiety, other things, that's going to really be an obstacle. So I began to talk more broadly with the kids about where they were, what their goals were, what was happening for them, and what they wanted to achieve for themselves in the context of their families and their goals. And I began to really couch it in terms of, you know, what do you want for yourself and for your life, and forget what I want, forget what your parents want, but really, you know, what do you want? And it helped me frame things differently working with kids. And I've tried to bring all of that to our training and to our tutors. We always talk about, you know, self-efficacy and self-concept and metacognition.
Yeah.
And we talk about anxiety. So we try to bring a broader brush, so it's not just the academic strategy, but really looking at the whole, the context in which the student lives.
Well said, my friend. And of course, what you're referring to is something that is known, as you know, the whole child, educating the whole child. But the other thing that, yeah, and I know you know that, Jed. But the other thing that struck me, and when did you start looking? I'm going at the SEL component. It sounds to me, I may be wrong, that considering your company started around 2001, you went back to school, etc. It seems to me like it was maybe around 2010 or something like that. And you can help me if I guess wrong there. That you saw that how important that SEL component is in tutoring. And the reason I'm asking that is because we all know today that social-emotional learning, okay, is so darn important. There's not a school district in the country that isn't implementing SEL, all right? But that's fairly new, okay? It certainly came to the forefront more than ever during the pandemic. But even before the pandemic, we talked about it. But, you know, we're talking about something maybe 5 years, all right? But it seems to me, the way I heard you say that, doctor, if I may, Dr. Appelruth, okay, educational psychologist, you figured this out before others did. Am I correct? You talk about that, when you incorporated that SEL stuff in there. Yeah.
That's right. It was about 04, 05, 06. And
wow,
when I began
even
to
earlier,
really understand,
though, yeah, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I went back to the doctor in, I think, 07. And then I began working on, you know, working with memory and learning and, you know, memory consolidation, all those other aspects of cognition. But when I was looking at, you know, my counseling background, learning about addictions and family systems, and that's where, you know, it really struck me when I was working with these kids in terms of what are their motivations. And what I really got early on, I began to do some research on, there's a guy, Albert Bandura, out at Stanford, and he's really important in defining this idea of self-efficacy. And it struck me in the head. It's like, I'm looking at his book right here on my shelf, but he understood that your beliefs and your ability to accomplish something are, in fact, more important than your actual abilities. And he had tons of research, and then trying to figure out what helps the students recreate higher self-efficacy beliefs. And one of the most important ones of all was having mastery experiences, having an experience of yourself as confident and capable was, you know, even a small one began to reinforce, you know, and change motivation and behavior towards goal attainment. And so that to me began to become a very big part of our tutoring was a student's belief system. What they believe about their abilities was absolutely paramount. And they could do all the work in the world, but if they had this big negative, you know, self-limiting belief that, you know, I'm not good at tests or I'm not good at chemistry, that was going to be a major obstacle and could negate a lot of the work that we were doing together. So it began to help my tutors think about changing self-belief as primary. And then, you know, we're building skills, but one of the key things we're trying to accomplish here is to change the students' beliefs and their ability and their view of themselves. And if we can do that, then the grades are going to come.
You know, that's so interesting. And how do you get that into the heads of your tutors, who I assume, and I may be wrong here, talk to me, I assume that your tutors are teachers, or I'll say educators. I don't know how to say that. You can define that a little better for me, all right? But what you just said is not taught. It may be soon, or it may be peeking its little head out of the window right now, okay? Most teachers know nothing about including that. Okay, they're not. I shouldn't say it that way. They don't teach. They don't teach teachers how to teach that. All right. And I'm curious, what are you doing? How are you finding the right tutors, et cetera, of which you have what 200 of them, 250 of them out there now. This is a big company. Again, everybody, Appelruth with Routh, Appelruth.com. Okay. How do you instill this in your people? This is great.
In our training. One of the key things we're doing is working with students and listening very closely when they vocalize their self-talk, when they make self-statements, when they begin to reveal their beliefs about their abilities. And it's little things, you know, and I've worked with kids, you know, years and years and years, and someone might say, you know, it comes out, I'm not, you know, I'm just not good at math. Or you see when they begin giving up prematurely, it's either observing through their behaviors when they're not as resilient, when they, you know, hit a hard thing, they throw up their hands, or They just say, you know, this is just, you know, I'm just not good at this. And then part of it, what I begin to, you know, do and teach my tutors is to scrub their self-belief system and to figure out where they came up with this idea and to begin to challenge it and poke holes in it.
Wow.
Oftentimes what happens when you have a belief like that becomes this monolithic thing. I'm bad at math. And what happens is anytime you have an outcome that goes counter to that, let's say you get an 85 or a 90 on a math test, you'll brush it off and say, oh, it was easy, or I got lucky. You'll begin to ascribe it to something other than your own abilities and talents and your processes. And so part of it, every time there's any kind of success a student has, I'm going to have them stop, and I force them to attend to it and talk about it. And what did you do to achieve that positive outcome? We're not going to say it was a teacher or it was luck or whatever it was, but, you know, what specifically did you do with your behaviors to create that success? And I keep having them focus again and again on that success, so they can't just brush it off. So typically, as you know, the human brain, you have a negativity bias. And if someone gives you a compliment versus an insult, the insult is going to stick with you longer than the compliment. And the same thing is, you know, opportunities versus threats. We have this big amygdala. We're scanning for threats, and these are scary. So we're just built to focus more on the negative. A part of it is helping you shift. And there's another book by Mari Seligman, Learned Optimism, like learning how to focus on the positive, which we can retrain our brains and our cognitive processes. And so it's having students begin to really attend and focus on the wins. And then little by little, as they do that, they begin to shift this idea of I'm not good at math, because suddenly I have counter evidence. And the more I make them talk about it and process it, that slowly starts whittling away at that one thought, that cognitive, you know, idea that I'm bad at math. And eventually, I've had students email me and text me. Now it's all texting. You know, they have a good outcome, a good test score. They're like, you know what? Maybe I'm not so bad at math after all.
Yeah.
And little by little, that belief changes, but it's through attention. You have to really focus their attention on their successes, and that's what Bandura called them, you know, these mastery experiences that are the most important thing. They're more important than you telling a student you can do this. That counts a little bit. They're more important than you observing your friend do this. Well, if he can do it, she can do it, I can do it. And it's more important than even how you feel, you know, do I feel comfortable or nervous? When you have a mastery experience and you focus on it, that begins to change your thoughts and views about yourself and your abilities. So that really is a key piece. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. I just find that fascinating and so positive, okay, and so good, and something I agree with you. I feel like I had a great psychology lesson just now, okay, that the audience did too. All right?
Excellent.
And you're the tutor, I call the Apple Ruth tutor, is really acting as a coach. And a psychologist,
right,
if I may, and a life coach, if I may. I mean, I find this, yes, sir. Go ahead. Continue, Jit.
I mean, I have to be careful in terms of calling them psychologists. I know. That's a control.
I did that. You didn't. I did that. Everybody, Jit did. Yeah.
There are aspects of you know, there are theoretical components which are built into our training, in terms of how do we change belief. And then from there, how does belief then change behavior? And that's baked in, and that's part of the work. And we also do trainings, you know, direct trainings on managing anxiety, helping students learn how to self-regulate their emotions. That's a key part, because we work with a lot of kids for testing, and like for the SAT and the ACT and the GRE, and a lot of students have anxiety about performance when they know there's a high-stakes testing event. And learning how to self-regulate, how to manage oneself is also important. So we're definitely doing aspects of things that I learned, some of the skills in my therapeutic training, in my ed psych classes. But for sure, I mean, all teachers do this, all coaches do this. We're working with humans, we're working with their feelings, we're working with their fears, their motivations. And I think that you ignore those at your peril if you're an educator. You can't just teach the content.
Exactly.
You have to address all of the whole, as you mentioned, the whole child, the whole student, where they come from, and previous blocks. So they had a teacher before who told them something that, you know, they weren't, somehow they formed a belief that I'm not as good at this. And that's going to affect how hard I try. That's going to affect the amount of energy and resources I pull in. And, you know, your beliefs inform everything. So to me, it's like, how do you not focus on that? And how do you not begin talking to a student about what do you believe you can accomplish here? Do you believe, are you open to the possibility of getting or an A in this class? Or, are, you know, what and what does success look like for you?
Yeah.
So that's really key, getting a sense of the calibration, where a student's starting from, where they believe they can go. And that's much independent from what the parents want. It's what does the student want and what does the student believe? Because if those are out of alignment, you know, the one that's going to win is the students.
Right, and then really most kids do want to succeed. Most kids absolutely do want to succeed. And I have to ask you, Jed, you know, we're talking, you're talking about, if I may, a block, something that prevents someone from finding the success they can achieve. Okay, you're able to help students, the Apple Ruth company, overcome this. All right, is that the only thing? Which I know the answer is going to be no, but what are the other common? Yeah, I didn't know how to segue into it. What's the most common blockers out there besides what you're besides the belief in achieving solid self-assessment, like you've been talking about? What are the other blockers out there? That's
the primary one.
I find this fascinating. Go ahead.
Oh, for sure.
Go ahead, Dr. Appleruth, please go ahead. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Larry. Yes,
really good.
When it comes to the blocks, when it comes to the things that are getting in the way, you definitely have some of the motivational components. You have the anxiety pieces, but to your, you mentioned as well that most kids will succeed if they can, unless there's some countervailing force against them or they don't want to succeed. The majority of kids want to do well, and the question is, what's happening?
Of course.
How are they being derailed? And one of the primary things and one of the key areas that we work in is in the space of executive functioning. And executive functioning, it's gaining currency. I don't know if you talked about it on your show.
Not really. Becoming, go ahead, please. Go into it.
And then the key word is, the word is to execute, to accomplish, to take, your cognitive processes, focusing, attending, gathering resources, all these things, and then driving them towards the attainment of a goal or an outcome. And so it's the ability to execute effectively. And a lot of students, they have the motivation, they want to do well, and then, they have the intelligence, the ability, but then they get jammed up when it comes to their executive functioning. And that's something, part of it is executive functioning skills, those that help you, achieve tasks, they develop until our mid-20s. We get better and better at things. I have a little daughter, and watching her attend and watching her attention span, I know in 3 or 4 years, it's going to be stronger than in 10 years, it'll be stronger than when she's in her mid-20s, she'll be able to do a lot more things. And so now, when I talk with parents whose kids are 13 and 14 and struggling, I explain, their ability to focus and attend and prioritize and organize, it's going to be better in 5 years. But the whole thing is, how do I help them now when they're struggling, when they could be failing out potentially? How do I help teach them how to use the skills they have and put in place systems to help support them? And these, again, these skills are planning, prioritization, organizing, time management, goal-directed persistence, task initiation, perseverance, and completion, all these things. Balance, being cognitively flexible, being able to shift gears if things aren't working, being able to stay, focus your attention when there are and inhibit distractions. These are all the executive functions. And there are kids who fall apart. And I know you know this, and we all have, and even in our own lives, there are times we get derailed. And it's like, REF skills, we get sidetracked. We do the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Of course.
We don't prioritize properly. It happens all the time to all of us because we're human. And it's interesting, as we're doing this executive functioning coaching, my tutors who are, they're highly functional people, they're realizing, there are ways in their lives they can improve, get better, minimize distractions, focus. We all want to be able to execute better and be more effective in life. And so with this work, it's helping understand student systems and where they're working, what time they're working, how are they getting help, how are they prioritizing, how are they structuring their physical environment, their digital environment. It's helping make things that are harder, making them easier through good systems, good structures, and taking things that are really easy and distracting and making them harder and putting them out of arm's reach. So in terms of managing, do you study with your phone right there? Do you have all your notifications on for Instagram or for Snapchat? How are you trying to focus and work and study? What time are you doing this? And when are you, when are you taking breaks? When are you putting in your playtime? And so it's helping them to think about their resources in a very systematic way, and helping kids who are getting, you know, B's and C's, helping them turn things around, even kids who are failing. And kids who were, I've realized this last semester, the power of zero to just hijack your grades. And kids, you know, you get two or three zeros in there, and
yeah,
it's hard to pass.
Oh,
even
man.
If it then wipes out all your B's and C's. So kids
absolutely.
Who aren't turning things in and then getting zeros, and also learning how to work with your teachers, how to, you know, communicate more effectively with the teachers, how to find out what you need to know before you go home, how to use office hours. And so we're doing a lot of work with executive functioning, and we're seeing the benefits, and helping kids also learn how to, you know, manage some frustration, you know, having some frustration tolerance, learning how to handle setbacks and not give up and fall into a it's all over kind of mindset, how to bounce back, and keep driving. And
yeah.
So we
resilience.
Are teaching kids
resilience. Yeah,
resilience is huge,
and
for us a lot of
huge.
It is. Helping them with their systems, because a lot of kids have weak systems. And so even if, you know, they try to hold it all in their head, and that's where they fall apart. Or they're looking only at what do I have tomorrow, not what do I have next week, next month, and I'm not looking at the calendar for the month. And learning how to think, you know, and strategize in terms of what resources do I have, what do I need, what's coming
yeah.
up. Because some kids just are looking at the next, you know, what's my next step, but they aren't thinking about I have this big thing coming up. And as we get to higher and higher grades, you have to begin, you know, getting smarter at planning. Or all of a sudden there's chaos. And a lot of our kids who are EF students, there's definitely a lot more chaos in their lives. There's a lot more fire drills. And they, you know, there was absence of planning. Then the question is, do the parents swoop in and save them or let them deal with the consequences? If they're, you know, and what I try to do with these kids is create a world for them and help them have less stress, have less chaos.
I think you're doing
that. Fewer fire drills. And we're doing it.
I think
and
you are doing it.
Yeah.
You are doing it. You know, I have to ask you something, which is, yeah, and you mentioned that you have a younger daughter, okay, which struck me in my mind. You Appleruth Tutoring does test prep. And when we talk about test prep, of course, we're talking about ACP, SAT, that sort of thing. But you also do academic tutoring. And I'm curious,
yes.
It struck me when you said that, what age do you start at? Because it seems to me that your philosophy of education is wonderful. Okay, I agree with it. Okay, do you work with kids in elementary school, or are you strictly high school or whatever? Where's that fit
we
in?
We are working with I would say 5% of our clients are like late elementary. That takes a certain educational skill. To work with young kids, it's
sure.
very different conversation. I'm working with a fifth grader right now, and for executive functioning skills, he was sent to me by a psychologist. And
sure.
But the majority of our business is definitely in that high school area for academics. But we have definitely moved in the past 10 years. We have quite a bit more middle school because that's where we see a lot
Aha.
more STEM issues,
Excellent.
more the math and science.
Excellent.
Because when kids start falling behind in grade 7,
yep.
you know, with math, and if they miss foundations, that's gonna carry forward for years.
You just reminded me of something.
Pandemic.
Wait, I have to tell you this story because I remember junior high school, and I remember my Spanish teacher. Okay, we were just this is the first time I had taken a foreign language. It was ninth grade. Okay, and this is way back when. And I remember I was kind of bored, and so for like 3 days I kind of zoned out, all right? But what she was talking about, all right, was conjugation of verbs, which is the basis of learning Spanish. And basically I was thinking about the Lone Ranger or the girl at the next desk or whatever I was thinking about while she was talking about the basis, okay, of the entire course. And from that day on I did terrible. Okay, in Spanish, and kids do zone out, and you have to get them mentally where they belong. It just struck me what you just said. I can relate, obviously, from my own experience. Okay, I can say como esta, but that's about it as we go all these years. Okay, so Miss Price, I'm sorry. If Jed had been around back then, I would have done a lot better. I apologize, Miss Price, who is probably 600 years old now. Okay, that's all I have to say on that one. It's really just amazing.
It's amazing.
How can You know, we're talking to a lot of teachers today, a lot of educators, I should say. And Jed, I have a feeling a lot of people are shaking their heads yes. Okay, and remember, you're dealing with individuals; they're dealing with whole classes here. Okay,
yep.
Tactics for teachers. What are some of the things they can do to help their kids with what you're talking about with teaching them these executive functions, executive functioning to make up any deficits they might have, the kids might have.
So
it's hard.
It is not easy because, and this has often been called the hidden curriculum. The executive functioning skills, still some students have them and they thrive. Some students don't and they struggle. And part of it, it's not often explicitly built into any curriculum. No one's teaching this. And when you ask students, where did you learn how to study? Who taught you? Sometimes the answer is, I just figured, whatever I learned from my sister, my brother, but no one stopped and showed them. And I was involved when I was at Georgia State. We were building a class Learning to Learn. And it was going to be helping undergraduates who would come into Georgia State. And, some of them, they were going to be academically at risk kids. And so there was actually a class for here are the foundational skills you need. Here's how you manage a project, your study environment, how you work with people, all these different components. And it was taught explicitly. It was direct instruction. And I think there is a room there. And part of it is, teachers may say, where is their time? How do I fit this in with my other academic content? But to spend a little time, and I have teachers who do this, who have them break open their notebooks, and writing things down and having, going and checking, are you writing down the homework? And you can definitely do this in middle school. And some schools are more focused on this, on building EF skills. Show me the planner. Show me where you wrote this down. Show me, because oftentimes, kids who have issues here, they write things down in haphazard places. It's not organized, and they aren't sure exactly what the homework was, or they start to interpret what they wrote down. And so having teachers, and especially if there is a student or two and you can see from their performance they're struggling or they're not doing the work in the right way that you asked, just to pull them aside for a moment and ask them, about their planner, where they're writing things down. And I noticed, you didn't get the directions right last time. You answered five, not eight things. And actually, a lot of it happens one-on-one for a moment and spell things out and ask everyone pick out your planner and look around and see, what they're working on. Is some kid writing on loose leaf and just throwing a thing into his backpack, or that, are they have actual planners? Some of them, mm-hmm. The schools provide them. I think there's room for it to talk about that. And of course, a lot of this does happen one-on-one when you realize kids aren't turning things in. And then, these can be short conversations, but kids, or they're turning them in late, asking for deadline, asking for extensions. That really is a telltale sign. A lot of my kids who are struggling with this work, they don't do the right thing at the right time, or they forget to bring it. So it's having a conversation. My sense is a lot is one-on-one, but you can definitely model some behaviors. And the teachers can be very explicit in terms of where they're writing things down, how they're explaining, making time for it. And some, many schools now are using technology and systems where they enter things. And it's just making sure you're using that with fidelity and kids know how to access that. And kids are, sometimes you can check if kids are logging into that. I do believe in telling students explicitly, here are some ideas for how to study. Here are some ideas for how to prepare for this exam. And not just, here's all the content, good luck, test is Friday. But doing some explicit instruction on optimizing your study time, and it's telling them it's better to read the question. It's better not to read the chapter five times, but it's a lot more effective if you do more self-testing, and that's going to help you with encoding the material and for long-term memory. And giving kids some ideas, because otherwise they just figure it out themselves, and oftentimes it's not the very best way they could do it. They could optimize if they try different approaches.
I hope everything you're saying is heard not only by parents, but also by educators, who many times are parents, all right? But, this is so key. And one of the things I think maybe you heard me say at the beginning of the show, we have a consortium for equity in education.
Yes.
And as you're saying this, I'm thinking you were talking about Georgia State, which is a good school down in Atlanta. Okay, I know several people who teach down there. Okay, and it's an urban school. All right, and we deal with the urban districts, et cetera, and many times under-resourced, et cetera. And what you're saying, okay, to help these kids, instead of continuing a race course down to the finish line of failure, okay, we have to get these kids to thinking about the things you're talking about. They can build themselves up to succeed. Thoughts on equity and what you guys do in Appleruth in terms of equity and access for all kids. Your thoughts, Dr. Appleruth.
Yes, and we're involved with NGOs, and we get involved with the Boys Clubs and a number of nonprofits. We do classes. We do classes like for the Atlanta Public Schools. We do a number of programs. And for lower SES schools, and where we go in there and we offer very discounted work and tutoring, both academic after school work, as well as for the SAT and the ACT, those kind of things. So we definitely, we build that in, into our work. And
so
in my sense is getting the message out, going and speaking. I've spoken in front of many groups, in different parts of Atlanta and in different parts of the city. And the parents show up because the parents care, and they
do.
Trying to find how do I help my students, and talking about somebody, I've talked about anxiety, talked about executive functioning, talk about organization and planning and systems, and they want to give their kids these skills, and sometimes it's just the framing of this conversation and being very explicit and talking about where is your kids studying, what time, all these things, which sometimes it's just go study. But to actually go and unpack and help them, and also let me see your planner, little tiny things. And kids, they don't want to be controlled.
That's
and
right.
Especially young men don't want to be controlled, but you can have a conversation. You can talk to them. And I try to minimize the use of control in everything because it often backfires and it creates resentment and other things when kids are trying to individuate and separate from the parents.
Yeah.
But still, you can engage them in a discussion, in a dialogue, in a way that's respectful, but also can guide them towards rethinking their approach and their what are their strategies. And then sometimes I hear the parents tell me, I've told my kids the same thing 1,000 times, but they can't hear it from me because I'm their parent and they just, they zone out. But with you, you're an outside party. Sometimes they may be able to hear it differently. But I still believe it's worth trying to have the conversation and to help, especially because the kids, if it's creating stress and if they want to do well and they're not, it's like, let's unpack that and not let's use punishment or rewards, but let's examine systems and processes, which are much more important than let me dangle a carrot or let me, put some punishment in place, which I don't like either one really.
Well, I'll tell you, you have created a great system, and I don't know your tutors, but I have a feeling they're very, very good at what they do. This is Jen. I got to tell you, this was a fascinating show. I really enjoyed it. I am going to create Appleruth Boulevard down in Atlanta. It may take some time, but I'm going to make it happen.
I will take it and slap it on some sign. Honest to God, hope I don't get arrested.
Four lanes, not just two. I'm giving you four lanes down there. You got Key West. You can have Atlanta now too. This was just great. I got to tell you, my friend. So, Jed, we got to go. I can listen to you all day. You really got the act together. This is a great company. All right. Thank you so much. What can I say? Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you too. It's great. Great to be here.
I'll be back to you. You take care. Be good. It's good to know you, Jed. Thank you. Bye bye.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Jed Appleruth, everybody. The company is Appleruth, Appleruth. Looks like Apple Ralph, but it's Appleruth.com. Okay, great system, great stuff, fascinating stuff. Jed, you really got some stuff together here. This is super. All right, we're going to archive the show over at ACE-ED.org and go over there and see what we're doing all about equity and access. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, the voice of the American Consortium for Equity in Education. Be safe out there. Have a good day.